Hello and welcome once again to the St Albans and District Talking Newspaper, serving St Albans, Harpenden and the surrounding areas. This is the primary edition for the week ending Saturday, the 4th of September, 2021. My name is Ian, I edit and produce the programme. This edition of Primary will again be distributed on USB sticks. Please remember to return them in the wallet provided when you have finished listening. Additionally, the programme is available on our website, sadtn.org.uk, under Listen Online. If you are using a mobile device, then it's available via the British Wireless for the Blind Fund app. This can be downloaded free via iTunes or Google Play. Search for Talking Newspaper. You can also tune into local life on Radio Verulam 92.6 FM and catch some news and other items you might find of interest in the programme hosted by Rob Pearman on Sunday, 8 to 9am and 6 to 7pm, and on Wednesday at 7pm. Amongst other items, this edition has, as usual on the USB stick distribution only, the BBC In Touch podcast. We'll also have the usual news roundup and the national radio listings read by John Cushing. Once again, we'll be delving into the Vocalise London Beyond site archives, with actor Michael Elwin describing St Martin in the Field. Continuing my love affair with New York, I'll be playing another American Vocalise piece, a description of the parachute jump at Coney Island Amusement Park. And we continue with a new item, rather like the radio listings. This is a list of audio-described programmes on TV. Please do let us know if this is useful. To finish, I'll be looking at past events and birthdays in the week. This week's music is Sentimental Blues by Gothby. Let's move on to the news, read by Christine, Deborah, Jane, David, Andy and Jess. And this week's Hertfordshire Advertiser leads with the story about the formal complaint to the council by 50 market traders.
Hello, I'm Jessica. Why have 50 St Albans charter market traders filed a formal complaint? 50 market traders have filed a formal complaint against a senior councillor alleging she has made a series of misleading claims to justify unpopular changes to the historic St Albans charter market. Their complaint is against Lib Dem councillor Mandy McNeil, who has repeatedly made the case for a cost-cutting switch from traditional market stalls to gazebos. Traders say claims made by Councillor McNeil gave a false impression that residents and businesses supported the change. They have also questioned the council's financial case for the overhaul. Former market insiders, who are liaising with the traders and have spoken to Hearts Ad, say they do not believe the market is losing the sums which the council has claimed. The traders behind the complaint, who represent a sizeable majority of the current market, say they believe the council's plan will ultimately destroy the market, taking down surrounding businesses in the process. They also claim the council is pretending to be open-minded, whilst really trying to force the changes through. In a cabinet meeting in March, councillors said the changes would only go ahead if a pilot scheme was successful. But the staff who erected the old stalls have already been made redundant before the pilot scheme has even begun. Income from a planned housing development on the market depot has been earmarked to deliver on an election pledge in the council leader's ward, doing up the Fleetville Community Centre. Some traders are now considering legal action against the council. Lib Dems have dismissed the traders' complaints as conspiracy theories. Why the change? For decades, St Albans Charter Market has lined St Peter's Street with more than 100 of its trademark uniform blue and yellow stalls. But last Wednesday, August the 25th, the market consisted of around 40 stalls, each different in appearance, spread, higgledy-piggledy, as one trader put it, between the museum and the entertainer. The only thing uniform last Wednesday was that so many of the stalls bore identical yellow posters declaring, "Save our charter market." Since last September, battle lines have been drawn between traders, some of whose stalls have run for over 50 years by multiple generations, and St Albans Council, SADC, which wants to take away their stalls and replace them with gazebos. The council claims radical changes are needed because the market is hemorrhaging money. According to Councillor Mandy McNeil, in 2010, the market had 170 traders and generated £700,000 per year. By 2018, she said it was down to around 80 traders and generating £500,000 in revenue. A 2019 audit report said the market was not currently financially viable without the council subsidising it. "We went from a surplus to a deficit that exponentially snowballed," Councillor McNeill told Cabinet in March, with losses at one point allegedly topping £180,000. "It's not rocket science," Councillor McNeill said. "If you're losing revenue and you've lost half your traders and your fixed costs go up, you're going to lose money unless you do something about it, toot sweet."
Hello, I'm Andy. The history behind this. Some say the council is approaching the problem with the wrong attitude. The charter market, held every Wednesday and Saturday, has operated since 1553 and is one of the city's key tourist attractions. If you go to the town centre on a Monday, Tuesday, Thursday, Friday, it's like a ghost town, said Mark Tyler, whose family has sold fruit and veg on the market for decades. But on market days, St Albans is a popular coach trip destination, and traders say the visitors from all over Hearts, London and Essex also spend money in shops, pubs, cafes and restaurants. "I have customers that come from Barnet every Saturday," said Mark. "The market works hand in hand with the shops. It brings footfall. I know an estate agent who says he's sold houses on the back of that market. How it looked, the atmosphere, the vibrancy. Where else can you go and see that now?" A report presented to the Cabinet after the consultation ended said that over 700 residents had responded. Approximately 90% of the comments were supportive of the market change, the document claimed, whereas only 10% commented on retaining the stalls or made any other comments around operations. This claim was repeated at an overview and scrutiny meeting on June the 17th, after Tory councillor Francis Leonard complained, "There was a consultation which basically said, do you want yellow gazebos or yellow gazebos? There wasn't a question about, do you want the original stalls back?" "That's partially incorrect," replied Mandy McNeill. "In the survey, there was actually ample room for comment, and in the comments, we got an overwhelming amount of people saying that they preferred the gazebos to stalls." The Lib Dems claimed there were 73 comments explicitly against gazebos, 67 explicitly in favour, and 28 which supported them with qualifications. But traders say that even if that's true, only 95 people expressed support for gazebos, whereas the council had claimed it was 90% of more than 700.
The Hearts Advertiser has in fact devoted 5 pages to this story, covering all angles and opinions. We have given you just a taste of it.
Hello, this is Deborah. Shenley Man set to walk from London to Glasgow to raise awareness of the climate change crisis. A Shenley primary school teacher is joining a multi-faith group walking from London to Glasgow to raise awareness of the climate crisis. Stephen Marcus, 58, will be part of a group of 40 walkers setting off from London on September the 5th on a 500-mile journey to the United Nations Climate Change Conference of Parties, COP26, arriving in Glasgow on October the 30th. Stephen said, "I am taking part because it seems a good way to highlight the issue of climate change by doing something that is challenging. I want to do all that I can to make a difference, and I look forward to the adventure." The group will reach St Albans on September the 7th, when there will be an outreach event at St Luke's Church in Selbarnes Lane at 7:30 p.m. Free tickets are available on Eventbrite, entitled "Hear About the Camino to COP." There will be another event in Harpenden at the same time on September the 8th. The walk has been called Camino to COP in reference to pilgrimages made since medieval times. It is inspired by the faith tradition of pilgrimage and great justice marches of the past, such as the Jarrow March in the UK, the Salt March in India, and the March on Washington in the US. The aim is to share personal human stories and inspire others to add their voices to the growing global chorus demanding that governments treat the climate crisis as the emergency that it is. The pilgrimage is also fundraising to empower activist groups in areas impacted by climate change. Here in the UK, we are already seeing increased flooding and extreme weather, and in the global south, people are already suffering in much greater ways, said Stephen. We need our government, as well as those of other powerful countries, to step up and make the changes needed to help us minimise the deadly effects of climate change and adapt to the challenges it brings. Traditionally, pilgrims rely on the hospitality of local communities, and the Camino to COP is no different. The walkers are grateful for the delivery of an evening meal or breakfast, and facilities to shower, and for laundry. The pilgrimage also welcomes day walkers to join them.
Hello, David Ireson with three items from this week's Hearts Advertiser. The first is titled Luella 8 Donates Hair to Children with Cancer. And there's a lovely picture of two pictures, really, of Luella, one with long hair and the second with a short bob. And in both of them, she's smiling broadly. A St Albans girl has braved the scissors to donate her locks to children with cancer. Luella Campagna, 8, has had her very long hair cut into a bob and now has a big smile on her face, knowing she has made a difference to others. She said, "I decided to cut my hair so children with cancer can have hair like everyone else, but as a wig." Luella has set up a fundraising page and has so far raised £370. Her dad, Sam, who owns several barber shops, said, "I'm so proud of her. As a barber, I know how significant hair is to people and what a difference this will make to a child who can benefit from it." To support Luella, go to www.justgiving.com/fundraising/Luella-Campagna, which is C-A-M-P-A-G-N-A. The hair will be given to the Little Princess Trust and made into a wig for a child who has hair loss due to cancer.
And this next item is about the night sky. More views of the stars at night are being reported across Hertfordshire. A new report shows a 10% increase in people reporting darker skies across Hertfordshire compared to 2020. In February, Countryside Charity CPRE's annual star count saw stargazers report a drop in light pollution, with 160 sightings of stars from across our county. Samantha Rolfe, Principal Technical Officer and Lecturer in Astrobiology at the University of Hertfordshire, said, "It's possible that this is related to lockdowns, where businesses have been closed or running reduced hours, so less lighting has leaked into our skies. There's also been a nationwide replacement of the old sodium street lighting, which leaked a lot of light. As this goes on, we will see less and less orange glow in the night sky, as LED bulbs are white and largely direct the light downwards. For us at the University of Hertfordshire's observatory, it means that our student observations will be less affected by stray light from light pollution, giving them the best results for their studies. Furthermore, when we hold public events, visitors will be able to see more stars than they would have previously." The observatory has been based in the grounds of Bayfordbury Mansion, just south of Hertford, since 1970, when Hatfield Polytechnic, now the University of Hertfordshire, was granted the site after it was acquired by the County Council. Starting with a 16-inch Cassegrain Newtonian telescope, which, with some upgrades, is still in operation, the observatory has expanded to include 8 telescope domes, 4 radio telescope dishes, and atmospheric monitoring equipment. Tanya Dixon, Managing Director of community interest company Culturewood, leads bat walks in late summer and early autumn in Letchworth and Wellingarden City. She said light pollution is a major issue for nocturnal animals. All our bat species are directly impacted by light pollution, especially the rarer species like greater and lesser horseshoe, as are loads of nocturnal animals and insects. If somewhere is well lit, I usually know bats won't be seen in that area, so I always go on bat walks, which are in fairly dark areas, so we can see as much activity as possible. It would be lovely to think lockdown has led to a renewed appreciation of nature and respect towards wildlife, but we'll have to see. Find out more about the impact of darker skies in the latest issue of Hertfordshire Life magazine, on sale now. And there's a photograph of astrophysicist Dr. Sam Rolfe, I guess that's Samantha because it's a lady, at the Bayfordbury Observatory. And she's standing beneath an absolutely huge, very technical looking telescope.
And this from the letters page. Shoddy state of our city's streets. Anyone who goes abroad to cities in other developed countries and then comes back and looks at our streets must feel ashamed. Their state, outside the main roads, is disgraceful. The council spends a lot of money on contractors, so why do our streets look so disgusting? Litter is everywhere. The grass-cutting contractors leave the cuttings on the grass, pavements and gutters, choking the grass and fouling the surrounding hard surfaces. Moreover, they make no attempt to cut the edges. The result is that grass and weeds encroach inwards into the pavements. I'm in correspondence with my councillor, Sarwar Shamsha, and have asked him, A, to find out the council policy on edge cutting. Is this part of the contract? If not, why not? B, to find out why the contractors are not clearing the cuttings off the pavements and roads as they are supposed to do. C, to find out the council policy on people putting boulders, logs, etc. on the verges to stop people parking there. Recently they cleared away those outside my house, but left all the others on my street. I am told that the problem is money. Therefore I have asked Councillor Shamsha to suggest to the council that the contractors cut less frequently, but do a proper job each time. 1. Cutting back the edges. 2. Clearing the cut grass. 3. Cleaning the pavements and gutters of weeds. 4. Picking up the litter. If it would, say, triple the time for each area, then to cut every 4 months would save money. Every area would see its edges cut back, pavements cleaned, and litter picked at least twice a year. Furthermore, there would be wildflower benefits. In addition, the workers might even be able to take some pride in their work. There cannot be much job satisfaction in leaving areas in even worse condition than when they came to them. It would be interesting to know if other readers agree with me that this is a problem that could and should be solved. David Kemble Cook, Gorham Drive, St Albans.
The following is the personal opinion as expressed by Nick Farr. Let them eat cake. Nick Farr of Farbrew looks at how the hospitality trade has been hit hard as supplies disappear. As you may have seen in the news, many industries are suffering from repeated and increasing supply issues. Nando's ran out of chicken last week, as did KFC a while back, not ideal for chicken restaurants. McDonald's ran out of milkshakes. The supermarket chain Iceland believe that a considerable percentage of their products will not be available for this Christmas. The head of the CBI was on the radio stating that the shortage in the availability of food and drink products was currently roughly akin to that last seen in 1983. Meanwhile, in the hospitality world, our issues continue unabated. Heineken are currently experiencing huge supply problems. This doesn't sound too bad, does it? until we realise that Heineken own and produce, well, Heineken, but also Amstel, Birra Moretti, Foster's, Strongbow, Inch's, Neck Oil, etc., etc. They are the principal supply source of nearly every single kegged product we sell across our 7 locations. In several pubs, we haven't had a full delivery from Heineken for several weeks. We put an order in, are told all is fine, and it just doesn't come. So we are constantly milling around, trying to source from others. I put an order in for 9 11-gallon kegs at one of our pubs last week. I got 2 4.5-gallon kegs. No notice. To keep supply going, we are calling everyone, driving all over the place, paying so much more than normal. All to keep things flowing. This is not meant to be a political piece, although I think you can probably guess which way the Far Brew team voted, but without any doubt, this issue is down to 75,000 HGV drivers leaving the country post, yes, you guessed it, Brexit. This has been compounded by COVID and the pingdemic following. Heineken's issues were then brought about by their principal logistics haulier going on strike. Why? Because they don't have enough drivers, so are asking their current ones to work harder, longer, more. There is no real sign of these issues ending. There are currently 90,000 advertised HGV driver positions in the UK. This issue impacts the whole supply chain too. The UK is missing roughly one third of our required dairy workers, and according to the head of the National Farmers Union, around 25% of farming vacancies go unfulfilled. These issues then transfer to the keg, the cask, and to the plate. Food orders are unpredictable, to say the least. We are often having to make changes on our menus at short notice, or simply remove whole sections from them. The largest ingredient supplier to the hospitality sector literally failed to deliver to us for over a month. Gas is also an issue. There has been a huge shortage of CO2, meaning we've not been able to bottle our beer for 3 months, leaving our shelves nearly empty. The poor reading rooms has hugely suffered due to this, though you should pop in for a pint, it's lovely. Thankfully, Jason and his team have been brewing like crazy recently and bottles have finally started returning. We also continue to have staff issues, the pingdemic carries on giving, and chefs are like hen's teeth right now. Anyone know any? 1.3 million workers left the UK post-Brexit, most of which worked in either hospitality or food production. These aren't negotiable figures, they are just facts. So what is my point? I seem just to be moaning. But the thing is, I don't mind all this, it's my job to sort problems. It's a challenge, and I quite like a challenge, but I will moan if people continue to blame my staff. We recently had a customer complain that crab cakes were not available that day. They were looking forward to them, and rightly so. Adam at the Bull hand makes them, and they're delicious. Unfortunately, we couldn't get crab meat that week. Now, I'm no chef, but I'm reasonably sure you need crab to make crab cakes. This customer had a huge hissy fit and basically shouted at our serving staff. We've also had folks hugely upset that their preferred lager brand wasn't available. We had someone complain last week that they had to wait 10 minutes for food. For food? We aren't a McDonald's. So my tirade ends. In short, don't blame the messenger. It is not the barmaid or waiter's fault if your preferred product isn't available. Please know that there have probably been a dozen phone calls, lots of driving around, several expected but failed deliveries, and a huge amount of frustration thrown in for free in trying to source that lager or crab cake. These are but just a few of dozens of examples of customers being rude to our staff. So I just ask this. Please understand that they are knackered, stressed, and trying very hard to get things right. So forget the cakes, forget the lager, have the cod and chips with a pint of Far Brew instead.
This article comes under the heading of transport. A new community initiative is hoping to raise the final amount of money needed to refurbish the surroundings of a historic railway station. Around £12,000 is needed to improve the environment around Smallford Station on the Auburn Way, with just £5,000 now needed to hit this target. Smallford Station is a unique 156-year-old Grade 2 listed building that used to serve the Hatfield and St Albans Railway, the track bed of which is now the Auburn Way foot and cycle path. Smallford Station and Auburn Way Heritage Society has recently received planning permission from St Albans District Council to improve the environment around the station ahead of a wider plan to eventually renovate the building itself. As part of this initiative, they will be installing Victorian-style benches and lamp posts, poster boards and raised flower beds, Smallford Station signs at the entrances, and an information board. They are also refurbishing an old goods van, which will be sited next to the platform to house an exhibition. Students from Oaklands College have designed Art Deco-style railway posters that will be displayed on the poster boards, while other students will be improving the platform brickwork, working on the raised flower beds, and undertaking improvements around the car park. Society Chairman Jeff Lewis said, "Our project is designed to sympathetically commemorate and celebrate this unique station and its surroundings, and provide an enhanced, accessible and attractive amenity for the local community and users of the Auburn Way." From 10 a.m. to 4 p.m. on Sunday, September the 12th, the Society will be participating in this year's Heritage Open Days at Smallford Station Car Park. There will be an exhibition celebrating the history and featuring a collection of artifacts and memorabilia. There will also be short guided walks from Smallford Station to Nasthyde Halt and back at 12 noon and 2 p.m. and refreshments provided by Colney Heath WI.
Ask and it happens. St Albans steps up to offer help to Afghan refugees. A locally run appeal for donations to help Afghan refugees has proved a phenomenal success, as hundreds of St Albans residents came forward to help. The initiative was run by mental health awareness charity It's OK to Say, in conjunction with Westminster Lodge, Ye Olde Fighting Cocks, Eyes on St Albans, Sopwell Community Trust, Oaklands College, St Saviour's Church, Acres Removals and RPL Removals. All week a team of volunteers have been sifting through suitcases, bags and boxes of clothes, blankets, toiletries, toys, craft, baby goods and more. But the donations keep flooding in. Charity founder Stacey Turner said, "I am so grateful to our wonderful community for their generosity. From the moment the mission went live on the HeartsAd website, help in many ways has flooded in. It's beautiful to see the community come together and help make this happen. I am blown away by the sheer power of humanity and care. We've been working hard here to pull together trauma support information ready for translation while the donations keep pouring in. We realise that the government will only help with this if the voluntary sector can't, and that could take a while." Christo Tafali, landlord of Ye Olde Fighting Cocks, said, "Ask St Albans, and it happens. We filled the restaurant areas in 2 days. It's OK to Say is a charity I'm raising money for on my bike ride to Scotland, and this is a perfect reason to help and explain why I'm doing it." Stacey added, "You're all amazing. I keep finding notes amongst the donations, so thank you. After such a terrible 2 years, this is community. This is salvation. This is tenacity. This is what it takes to help rebuild the lives of evacuees, but also to help bring people out to weave themselves back within society." A sorting afternoon to prepare the donations for distribution is taking place this Saturday, September the 4th, at St Saviour's Church in St Albans between 2 and 6 p.m. There'll be a band, a children's entertainer, food and more. And there's a lovely picture of Stacey surrounded by bags of donated items.
The next item is from the letters page and is titled, "We All Need to Do Our Bit for Refugees." We have all seen the horrifying TV pictures from Kabul recently and are aware of what is happening and are going to happen shortly throughout Afghanistan. No doubt we also have criticisms to make regarding the actions and inactions of various governments and civil servants, and then feel despair that there is nothing we can personally do about it. But there is one thing that we can all do, at least for the Afghan refugees who managed to escape to the UK. Those poor people who are arriving here have nothing but the clothes they are standing in, and that is where we can all help. We can look into our wardrobes and sort out what no longer fits us, or some clothing which we never wear now, and quickly send it to help those in need. We need to do that now, not next week. Time is of the essence. It is not relevant what religion we follow, or even if we are atheist. These are people who are in need and who need our help now. So please look into your wardrobe today. In our area, we know of two organisations that are accepting clothing and children's toys for Afghan refugees, and there will certainly be some in your own area also. This letter is from Ken Shuttleworth of Reynards Way, Brickett Wood.
A Harpenden mum returns to the recording studio for the first time since 2002. What you might do when your youngest child is set up to leave for university and the house is likely to feel empty, what do you do? For one Harpenden mum, it's a chance to reawaken her musical career after it'd been lying dormant for 18 years and release her first song since 2002. After raising twin girls as a single mum, Donna Canali, who lives in Waldegrave Park, Harpenden, was worried about finding herself at a loose end when both girls leave home, and she decided to return to her past love as a jazz musician. She explained, "Now that they are about to leave home for university, I'm determined to throw myself back into the musical fray. I want to make sure I have a meaningful and musically creative project to focus on that will help prevent me from falling into a grief-filled emptiness once they've gone. My girls love the fact that I've been preparing in a positive way for their imminent departure, although they get a bit impatient when they have to hush up if I'm recording a vocal take in the living room, which is a makeshift studio. I recently booked a day of video recording songs in a studio down in Cardiff and dragged them along with me to do backing vocals. Sometimes they feel a bit embarrassed that I involve them, but I suspect they're secretly very proud of my efforts. We're a tight little family, and I'm so grateful for their support and patience. They also help me with the tech for social media. In fact, I think I'll have to cram in a lesson on how to navigate Instagram before they go." She's penned a new song, Waltz for the Girls, inspired by her daughters, which she described as a self-penned music starting with a beguiling folk-influenced song with a lilting waltz rhythm. The uplifting soundscape created in the single is a blend of gentle mandolin, guitar and piano, which steadily swells into a soaring, fully orchestrated second chorus and inspires a poignant surge of emotion. Donna said, "Although I come from a jazzy background, my style is varied and this particular song is more folksy, but definitely accessible to all who like good quality music. This song emerged almost as a lullaby and evoked the language and narrative used when tucking your little ones into bed at night. It's a special wee ritual that everyone can relate to, whether as that once upon a time child or as a parent themselves." Performer and sessions vocalist Donna has appeared at the Royal Festival Hall, the London Palladium, the Barbican, and most major concert halls around the UK and Ireland as the special guest in numerous big band shows, as well as touring in Japan and the Middle East. Drawing on more than 3 decades' experience as a singer, including pop chart-busting hits Mucho Mambo, or Sway, and Mambo Italiano for the dance act Shaft, Donna has rediscovered the joy and simplicity of just being with guitar and voice, and is currently recording a new album, which includes the new track. Her last album, Thinking of You, came out back in 2002. Then Donna stepped back from the touring life in order to raise her twin daughters. There is no love like the love for your children. All my life, I've put others' needs ahead of my own. I've dedicated over 30 years in the industry to other artists' music, but this new original music is about taking back control and shining a spotlight on my story. I'm doing this for me. I think, having experienced the highs and lows of life, it would be such a waste to not try to share my songs, which are stories about real feelings, real events, and everything that maturity brings. Waltz for the Girls is available on Spotify and other streaming platforms from the 3rd of September. And there's a photograph of Donna standing in an empty street. She's wearing a black leather jacket, black trousers, and she's carrying her guitar.
And now this from the letters page, Time and Money. A very interesting article from Philip Aylett on behalf of the New Hospital Campaign in your August the 19th edition. I spent a working lifetime managing the design and pre-construction delivery of buildings, including hospitals for national contractors, and would generally agree with the contents of his letter. However, to clarify a few points, building costs have very little variance across the country. High-rise buildings are generally faster to build than the floor space equivalent of low-rise buildings, as they can be fitted out at an earlier point in time on the construction programme, while the upper parts of the structural frame are still under construction. Building cost inflation is likely to exceed 2% per annum, given the current materials shortages, particularly as metal and steel inflation has been going up by 30% in just a few months, and there will be a lot of steel and metal in the buildings. My experience of delivering hospitals tells me a period of 2.5 to 3 years will be required from the outset to agree a detailed, acceptable scheme design with the Trust's departmental users, with accompanying firm price offer from a contractor with full agreement of all legal obligations, and a further 5 years to construct the buildings, plus another 3 months for commissioning, totalling 7 to 8 years. It is very clear the saga will run for some time before a new hospital is built, and a lot of money is highly likely to be wasted in getting there. Trevor Williams, by email.
Theatre Company's first production of new season. The curtain rises on the Company of Ten's first production of the new season at the Abbey Theatre in St Albans this month. Peter Quilter's hilarious comedy, Curtain Up, is a madcap play full of quickfire dialogue and several surprises. It's about a group of women who inherit a derelict theatre. Michael has died and left a dilapidated theatre to his nearest and dearest, his daughter Teresa, ex-wife Pam, mother Betty, former PA Sharon, and finally Jackie, his lover, and the woman for whom he left his wife. There are fireworks ahead as the comedy centres around the interaction between the women and their sometimes volatile relationships. With 5 strong female roles in an ensemble cast, this tremendous, fast-paced show has had audiences laughing across the UK and abroad for the past decade. Our heroines find themselves involved in madness and mayhem as they try to save the theatre from destruction, at one point even inviting a well-known showbiz star to stage a spectacular concert. There's physical comedy, witty dialogue, dance routines and slapstick, and the play will leave you on a real high. This is a family affair for the Company of Ten, with a mother and daughter team playing mother and daughter on stage. Catherine Barry plays Pam and Emma Barry plays her daughter Teresa. Catherine says, "It is a joy working with Emma. There is a real rapport between us, and because we know each other so well, it has been easy to portray the closeness and conflict that exists between mother and daughter. I hope we can do it again sometime." Playwright Peter Quilter was the Olivier Award-nominated writer behind the Oscar-winning film Judy, starring Renee Zellweger. His play, Curtain Up, is the perfect opener to the Company of Ten season and will keep you in stitches throughout. Performances take place on the Abbey Theatre main stage from Friday, September the 17th to Saturday, September the 25th at 8 p.m. and on Sunday, September the 19th at 2:30 p.m.
Beer and Pubs Festival. Cheers! Preparations are taking shape for this year's St Albans Beer and Pubs Festival. The city's first festival of pubs is just 1 month away, and the milestone has been marked with the launch of a new website and an initial list of featured events. In place of the traditional St Albans Beer and Cider Festival, held at the Alban Arena, organisers from the Campaign for Real Ale have this year adopted a new approach, coordinating an extravaganza of pub-based attractions taking place across numerous venues. Festival organiser Adrian Saunders said, "Every year, for a quarter of a century, the festival has always provided a boost for local venues by bringing beer lovers into the city. But after the events of the past 18 months and the extent to which the trade has suffered, we wanted to make this year's festival 100% about St Albans pubs. This is a festival that everyone is invited to get involved with. We have dozens of events in our 10-day calendar already, but we would love any pub that isn't already featured to get in touch for a chat about how that they can also be part of the fun. Running between September the 24th and October the 3rd, a period which coincides with National Cask Ale Week, dozens of events will take place in St Albans hostelries. Events already confirmed are beer and cider festivals hosted at The Mermaid, Great Northern, Farmer's Boy and White Hart Tap, 2 open weekends at the Three Brewers of St Albans Brewery, talks and tasting sessions by celebrated beer writer Roger Protts at the Robin Hood and Ye Olde Fighting Cocks, Meet the Brewer sessions with Wells & Co. at the Jolly Sailor, with Tring Brewery, venue to be confirmed, and with other breweries still to be announced. A chance to learn about cider and perry at the Mermaid. A special beer-themed dinner menu at Lussman's. Live music, including at The Horn, Garibaldi, Blacksmith's Arms, Goat and many others. Other activities across different venues, including quiz nights, pub games and even an invigorating group run, starting and finishing at the Craft and Cleaver.
The heading for this article is Black Futures, a significant moment for our city. A sold-out crowd attended the Black Futures event held at St Albans Museum and Gallery. The round table discussion brought together 6 guest speakers in a belated celebration of Windrush Day, and 1 year on from the Black Lives Matter protests. The date also coincided with Jamaica Independence Day. In the diverse crowd were a number of local residents who had made the journey over to St Albans from the Caribbean in their early youth during the 1970s. St Albans MP Daisy Cooper, deputy leader for the Liberal Democrats, was also in attendance, as was new Hertfordshire High Sheriff Lionel Wallace. Organiser Shelley Hales said, "I really feel like history was made in what I hope will be the first of many Black Futures events. That it took place in such a cherished central venue as the St Albans Museum and Gallery felt like a significant moment for our city." Topics discussed included inclusivity and how the Black British Caribbean community in St Albans have contributed locally for years, and the need for more visibility of Black role models from all sectors, and the celebration and promotion of their success in the media. "Many important points were raised," said Shelley. "In particular, what stood out for me was the active intergenerational audience participation. The strong message that I received during the evening was one of hope for real change and a renewed drive for a permanent community accommodation. Active Lifestyles, the voluntary organisation that manages the Caribbean Luncheon Club in St Albans, had members from 40 different nationalities until lockdown. Until the Black Futures event, I didn't know that Andreen McDonald had been trying for almost 20 years to have a permanent base for it locally. Maybe change is coming. I wait with bated breath. MP Daisy Cooper added, I want to extend my warm congratulations to all those involved in the event, which was nostalgic, poignant, funny and forward-looking. I was really struck by the contrast between the stories of older black residents describing their experiences of growing up in St Albans, with their strong collective sense of culture, identity and fun, with some of the younger residents who in some cases said that they really struggled growing up here until they learnt more about what their black identity meant to them. And there's a photograph of MP Daisy Cooper and Shelley Hales in front of the Black Futures logo inside the St Albans Museum and Gallery.
Following a 16-month touring and festival hiatus imposed by the COVID pandemic, Dyad Productions returns to the stage next week. The opening production of the new season at the Maltings Theatre will be the premiere of Dyad's A Room of One's Own, from the award-winning creators of Austin's Women and I, Elizabeth. A Room of One's Own opens in St Albans on Tuesday, September the 7th. Rebecca Vaughan will be performing Virginia Woolf's 1928 exploration of the impact of poverty and sexual inequality on intellectual freedom and creativity. We caught up with Rebecca ahead of the show's opening night for a quick question and answer. When did you discover or first read Virginia Woolf's A Room of One's Own? I read it when I was at Cardiff University studying English literature. At that point, I really fell in love with Virginia Woolf generally. At Dyad Productions, we've also adapted other Virginia Woolf works, including Orlando and Mrs. Dalloway. What did you like most about it? I loved that the work is groundbreaking. Woolf's really looking into how things can really change and move forward for female independence, both financially and creatively. I've been interested in putting the show on stage for quite a few years now. What's fascinating is that although she wrote it in 1928, when women had only had the vote for 10 years, there's still so much that's either not changed or is still really relevant. How did you put together the script, and what will audiences gain from seeing the show? The script was a collaboration with Elton Townend Jones. He and I work very closely on all our scripts. We script edit together throughout the whole process. I think audiences will find it thought-provoking, inspiring, motivational. Virginia Woolf's wit and her trip through the history of literature, as well as the way she regularly imagines what life will be like in 100 years' time, i.e. 2028, is really fun. I think it also presents an organic perspective on the issues of women's place in society and the role that men play within that framework. A Room of One's Own can be seen at the Maltings Theatre in St Albans from Tuesday, September the 7th to Saturday, September the 11th at 7:30.
And now, a list of deaths as published in this week's Hertfordshire Advertiser. Ray Warren, aged 75. Kathleen Ruby Jarman, 100. Joan Yvonne Pierce, 93. Jill Prizeman, 85. Honorary Alderman Agnes Hill. Anthony John Skinner, 85. Marceline Clark, 85. Margaret Ellen Walsh. A little more music from Gothby now, followed by John Cushing reading the radio listings.
As the nights continue to draw in and we move further into autumn, time for a look at some of this coming week's radio highlights, starting with Saturday, September 4th. The play on Radio 4 at 2:45 is The Bulbul Was Singing. A British woman returns from fighting with the Kurds to find herself charged with terrorist offences. Different States is a political thriller on Radio 4 Extra at 4 p.m. It's a Sony Award winner for Best Original Script and Best Drama Production. You could spend hours with Moira Stewart on Classic FM from 4 p.m. as she chooses works from her Hall of Fame. The composers include Bach, Handel and Elgar. Back to politics, though, on Radio 4 at 5:30, when Nick Robinson shews some political thinking with a politician who tells him about their life and career. The Infinite Monkey Cage returns for a new series at 7:15 on Radio 4, when Robin Ince and Brian Cox discuss the end of the universe with guests from the worlds of comedy and science. Radio 4 Extra has a Sherlock Holmes special, The Games Afoot, from 7 till 10, when various incarnations of the detective can be heard solving many cases. The whole series of G.F. Newman's The Corrupted is being rebroadcast, with the first of 10 episodes airing on Radio 4 at 9 p.m. The cast includes Toby Jones, Ross Kemp and Robert Glenister, and takes us through six decades, starting tonight in 1951. And David Meller's Melodies at 9 p.m. on Classic FM focuses on the concerto, including Beethoven's Emperor Concerto. On to Sunday, September 5th, Dangerous Liaisons on Radio 4 is at 3 o'clock. At 5 p.m. on Radio 4 Extra, Poetry Extra imagines what the news would be like if presented as poetry, followed at 5:30 by John Finnemore's Souvenir Programme. More comedy on Radio 4 at 7:15, when a sparkling cast deliver another batch of Michael Frayn's comedic monologues. Tonight's prom at 7:30 on Radio 3 contains a performance of Dvorak's Cello Concerto with Sekou Kane Mason as soloist. And a choice at 9, Radio 2, Claudia Winkleman fronts a montage of the sounds of the 21st century, while on Classic FM, Moira Stewart meets well-known names for music, sport and entertainment, and talks about a significant piece of music in their lives. On to programmes then that are serialised Monday to Friday, same time, same radio station, Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, Friday. So daily at the same time on the same radio station. You know where we're going. Okay, the book of the week at 9:45 in the morning on Radio 4 is The Daughters of Kabul. It's the story of the women who took on the Islamic State and won, by war reporter Gail Lemon. Composer of the week at noon on Radio 3 is Rachmaninoff. The midday novel, repeated at the Book of Bedtime at 10:45 on Radio 4, is The Fortnight in September by R.C. Sheriff. It's the story of an ordinary family and their annual holiday to Bognor Regis. So further 10 episodes of A History of the World in 100 Objects at 1:45 on Radio 4, Monday to Friday, all week. And The Prime Minister's Props at 7:45 on Radio 4, each night, discusses such objects as Churchill's cigar, Thatcher's handbag, and kicks off with Wellington's boots. The Classic FM concert with John Suchet can be heard each evening at 8. For the next 2 weeks, the playlist is taken from works from the Classic FM Hall of Fame, as voted for by listeners. And at this point, it might be useful to mention the test matches, because they do interfere with some of the schedules for Radio 4. On Saturday, Sunday and Monday, the fourth test will be available on Radio 4 Longwave from 10:45 till 7, and on 5 Live Sports Extra from 10:15 all the way through to 7 p.m. So let's look at some of those other programmes for later in the week, starting with Monday, September 6th at 9 a.m. on Radio 4. In How to Play, Sir Mark Elder and the Halle Orchestra discuss playing Elgar's Enigma Variations. Drama on Radio 4 Extra at 3, the first of three in the miniseries, Posters of the Moulin Rouge. In Beyond Belief at 4:30 on Radio 4, Ernie Ray and guests may help to enlighten us in the discussion, What Do the Taliban Believe? Good news for Just a Minute fans, as the new series starts at 6:30 on Radio 4, and of course it's Sue Perkins who will be chairing the quiz. Classic comedy on Radio 4 Extra from 7pm, starting with Steptoe and Son, followed at 7:30 by the Wordsworths of Gorsemere, and at 8 by a Charles Paris comic murder mystery, So Much Blood. And The Blues Show with Kerris Matthews rounds off your Monday at 9pm on Radio 2. A scientific start to Tuesday, September 7th. 9am, Radio 4, Jim Al-Khalili talks to Hannah Fry about her life in mathematics in Hannah Fry on the Power and Perils of Big Data. The continued relevance of Dante is examined at 11:30 on Radio 4 in Dante 2021, The Inferno. Brief Lives at 2:15 on Radio 4 continues the drama series about the legal advisers in Manchester. A watery couple of programmes can be heard from 3:30 on Radio 4. In Costing the Earth, Tom Heap takes a canoe trip along the River Cam in Cambridgeshire to examine possible pollution. While at 4, folk singer Sam Lee reveals the music, ecology and folklore along the 215 miles of the Thames. Radio 3, Prom, 7:30, Beethoven's Piano Concerto No. 4 and Saint-Saëns Symphony No. 3. In Touch at 8:40 on Radio 4, as it's a Tuesday. And The Jazz Show with Jamie Cullum is at 9 on Radio 2. Wednesday, September 8th, brings a discussion on the subject which obsesses so many British people. Not the weather, class. In Thinking Aloud at 4pm on Radio 4, two academics discuss class and culture with Laurie Taylor and wonder why so many people from privileged class backgrounds often misidentify their origin as working class. Radio 2 at 7 has The Joe Wiley Show, when she plays new music plus 30 minutes of feel-good music and a guest. Marla and Shoshka Kovic feature in tonight's Prom at 7:30 on Radio 4. And at 8 on Radio 4 in 9/11, The Arc of History, Ed Staunton and guests examine whether the arc of the moral universe is still bending in the right direction. The Folk Show with Mark Radcliffe, slightly different tone, 9pm. Radio 2. Thursday, September 9th, and John Harris concludes his series at 9am on Radio 4, Citizens of Somewhere, when he visits Perth in Scotland to talk to people about their lives and how they feel about the place they live. Crossing Continents at 11am on Radio 4 investigates the Havana Syndrome, which sounds like a thriller, but diplomats from North America claim to be the victims of some form of microwave attack while on duty in Havana. The drama at 3 on Radio 4 Extra is closed to visitors. While on 3 on Radio 4, Ramblings has Claire Balding walking in Fife on a route which is home to rare white stags. Fancy an hour of comedy? Radio 4 Extra at 7pm, The Navy Lark and After Henry at 7:30. Barks St Matthew's Passion features in tonight's Prom at 7pm on Radio 3. And Bob Harris is on Radio 2 at 9pm with The Country Show. Finally, a welcome return on Friday, September 10th, on Radio 4 at 11:30 for the actor-detective Charles Paris. When playing a monk in a West End play, a fellow actor falls down the stairs. An accident or something more sinister? The 2:15 drama on Radio 4 is part 3 of Nuremberg, when the prosecutors hear about Auschwitz for the first time. The news quiz, hosted by Andy Zaltman, is at 6:30 on Radio 4. And join Tony Blackburn at 7 on Radio 2 for his golden hour. Well, if you've missed it, there's an omnibus edition of A History of the World in 100 Objects at 9pm on Radio 4, where you can hear all 5 episodes from the past week. As ever, may I wish you a peaceful, safe and enjoyable week of radio listening.
Thanks very much, John. Now another from our series, London Beyond Sight. This is one of the many items that can be found on the Vocalise website. This time, the actor Michael Elwin describes St Martin-in-the-Fields.
My name is Michael Elwin. I'm an actor and occasional director, and I've been in this business since 1964. I have a close family connection with St Martin in the Fields through my mother's brother, Eric Loveday, who was the much-respected vicar here between 1941 and 1947. Even as a small boy, I was aware that Uncle Eric had an important position. He was vicar to the Prime Minister and the Royal Family, as both 10 Downing Street and Buckingham Palace lie within the parish boundaries. Sadly, I only knew him for a short time because of his early death in Australia while on a preaching tour after the war. There's a memorial to him in St Paul's Cathedral, Melbourne, where he preached his last sermon. St Martin stands on the northeast corner of Trafalgar Square. There's been a church on this site since the 13th century, and as the name suggests, it was originally surrounded by fields. The present building dates from 1726 and was designed by James Gibbs, an architect much influenced by Sir Christopher Wren. There are lots of imposing buildings surrounding the square, but St Martin's stands out with its tall spire and its grand exterior, particularly as it's recently been cleaned and restored. A wide flight of stone steps leads up from the pavement to the high stone-flagged porch. The triangular pediment of the porch is supported by 8 massive stone columns, and standing just inside the porch is a modern sculpture in Portland stone designed by Mike Chapman to mark the millennium. You can stand on a step and touch the naked newborn child, still attached with an umbilical cord, to the block of stone from which he's been carved. The words running around the stone are from St John's Gospel. In the beginning was the Word. Inside, the church is a bright, calm space after the bustle outside. As part of the refurbishment, it's been redecorated in pale cream with discreet touches of gold. There's a central aisle and others on either side below a gallery which runs along both sides of the nave. Between the aisles are rows of dark oak pews, and towards the front on the left is a tall 18th century wooden pulpit, its 6 panels carved with cherubs and shells. The ceiling is barrel-shaped and decorated with intricate plasterwork. There are 2 rows of chandeliers, but during some of the concerts that take place here in the evenings, the church glows with a soft light from hundreds of candles. In the daytime, though, the space is flooded with light through the tall arched windows at ground and first floor level. On the ceiling of the sanctuary is a dazzling golden sunburst representing God, and a coat of arms with a globe, a golden lion, and a white unicorn. The royal coat of arms of King George I, who was the first church warden. To right and left of the sanctuary are 2 doors which lead up to rooms with small paned windows overlooking the altar. The room on the right was set aside for the First Lord of the Admiralty, that on the left reserved for the royal family. The triple window at the far end is of plain etched glass within a steel web of vertical and horizontal black stripes. A third of the way down, the web is stretched out of shape by an oval section resembling a hole, a controversial design. It looks to some as if a stone has been cast through the glass. Others can see a cross in the design, the oval being perhaps the shape of a head inclined to one side. The window is intended to inspire reflection and prayer and was designed in 2006 by the Iranian artist Shirazeh Hushyari and the architect Pip Horn. St Martin's has been described as an interfaith church, a place of welcome for believers, doubters, and those who are seeking. Its patron saint is St Martin, who showed compassion by slashing his cloak in half and sharing it with a beggar. Dick Shepherd, who was an army chaplain and then the vicar of St Martin's during the First World War, followed the saint's example by offering food and shelter to weary soldiers returning from the trenches. The crypt became an air raid shelter during both world wars, and the church became established as a centre for social work, offering support for unemployed ex-soldiers and help for people in distress. It still provides accommodation for rough sleepers through a project called The Connection, which cares for around 7,500 people each year. The door is always open to the homeless, who are welcome to rest in the church. St. Martin's has a strong musical tradition and became renowned for Baroque and early music through the concerts broadcast during the war by the BBC. Later, the world-famous Academy of St. Martin in the Fields was formed by Sir Neville Mariner. People still flock to the free lunchtime concerts of classical music, the candlelit concerts in the evenings, and jazz in the crypt. During the Second World War, my uncle founded the St. Martin Singers, formed from a group of fire watchers who sang together between stints of duty on the church roof. This group still exists, and the Singers hold regular concerts in aid of UK charities. The restoration project has made St. Martin's more welcoming than ever. A glass pavilion to the left of the building provides access by stairs and lift to underground spaces, lit by natural light flooding down from a circular glass light well. There's a spacious new foyer and shop, and the crypt houses a cafe serving home-cooked food. A wide corridor leads to a Chinese community centre, and also to the simple Dick Shepherd Chapel, a quiet place of reflection at the heart of the busy city. If you visit, there's an audio guide of the church, available from the shop in the crypt, that's been especially prepared for blind or partially sighted visitors, and includes more detailed description. Part of a poem by Andrew Motion can be found inscribed on the handrail around the top of the circular lightwell in Church Walk. It was written in 2006, and it reads, "Now traveller, whose journey passes through tall courts of shifting light and trudging crowds, continually worn down but always new, your stepping inwards from the air to earth winds round itself to meet the open sky, so vanishing becomes a second birth. Farewell, return. Farewell, return again. Here home and elsewhere share one mystery. Here love and conscience sing the same refrain. Here time leaps up and strikes eternity."
More music now, and here's the full-length version of Sentimental Blues by Gothby. As I started my career in theatre, I was fascinated by this next piece from TNF Soundings, a fascinating examination of the so-called Curse of Macbeth.
TNF Soundings. Features from across the UK.
Hello, I'm Colin. Do you like Shakespeare? Now come on, really. When asked that question, most people almost invariably reply, yes. When, in all honesty, they're not actually too bothered about the Bard of Avon and his first folio, or any other folio for that matter. Me, well, as it happens, I can take him or leave him. I better pause here to allow any Shakespeare stalwarts to pick themselves up from the floor. Not bothered about the world's most famous playwright? Are you serious? Yes, quite serious, thank you. Look, think about it for a moment. Shakespeare wrote, what, 38 plays? Pretty good going, I grant you, for someone who only had pen and paper to work with. But not perhaps as prolific as some others I could mention. It might surprise you to learn that Alan Ayckbourn has, to date, written more than 80 plays. That's almost one for every year of his life. I mean, I'm just saying. Anyway, whether you're a fan of Our Will or not, you're bound to have heard of his bloodthirsty epic, Macbeth. And you've probably also heard of the play's famous curse. The legend, long feared among theatrical folk, insists that neither the production's title nor any quotes from it should ever be spoken in a theatre outside of a rehearsal or performance itself. To break the taboo is to invite terrible things to happen. Most actors are happy to tell you about disasters which have occurred simply because someone uttered the name Macbeth. Here are a few examples to illustrate the power of the dreaded curse. Prior to a performance of the definitely non-Shakespearean River Dance, a member of the orchestra had the effrontery to joke about the famous curse. And guess what? Shock horror. That night, two of the violinist's strings snapped spontaneously. A woman fell off the stage, and another danced straight into a wall and knocked herself out. In 1672, the actor playing Macbeth used a real dagger, as opposed to the prop he was supposed to use, and managed to kill Duncan on stage, right in front of the audience. Not as fatal, but in 1948, actress Diana Wynard, in those days they were called actresses as opposed to actors, fell 15 feet into a pit during a production of Macbeth when she walked off the stage with her eyes closed in the sleepwalking scene. With her eyes closed? You have to ask yourself, was that wise? I'm all for theatrical authenticity, but in a production of Mary Stuart in Vienna, the audience was impressed by how real a suicide looked in a scene where the actor was supposed to slit his own throat. You know what's coming, don't you? In rehearsal, the prop knife had broken, so a new replacement was used. Someone neglected to blunt the blade of the knife, enabling the actor to successfully slit his throat. He stumbled off stage and was rushed to hospital. Luckily, he survived. Cutting your own throat not alarming enough for you? In a Royal Shakespeare Company production of Antony and Cleopatra, an actor managed to shoot himself in the hand. Now, call me old-fashioned, but did they have guns in ancient Egypt? Trooper that he was, he later carried on with a bandaged hand and his arm in a sling. So much for modern interpretations of the classics. In 1942, three actors died, I'm not sure how, during the run of the Piccadilly Theatre's version of Macbeth starring John Gielgud. The costume designer committed suicide. One of the most infamous incidents actually has little to do with the play itself. In 1849, English actor-manager William Macready was touring in Macbeth in America. He'd developed a rivalry with American actor Edwin Forrest, who was starring in another version. When MacReady went to perform at the Astor Opera House in New York, Forrest's supporters showed up. When MacReady went on stage, riots broke out. Soldiers fired into the crowd, and about 20 people died. So, where did this saga begin? One theory is that the play was cursed when Shakespeare used elements of real spells in the scenes that featured the witches. Apparently, it was enough to jinx the play, because the witches became angry that the spells used were incomplete, and so cursed the play to exact their revenge. Presumably, he didn't use a spell checker. I'm sorry, I couldn't resist that. If he did actually use real spells, was it just bad luck that some real witches happened to drop into a performance and picked up on the fact that the spells were incomplete? I know what I think. Another theory, a bit above my head this one, is that the witch's verse is written in something called tetrameter. It means four rhythmic feet to each line. Okay. Whereas Shakespeare's verse usually uses pentameter. This makes the witch's lines very witchy. But surely that's the point. It's also thought that as well as the folklore which kicked off this whole curse thing, there are practical reasons to link Macbeth with misfortune. It happens to be one of Shakespeare's most popular plays, and it also tends to run longer than some of his other plays. And so statistically, well, I knew before long statistics would poke their nose in, it's more likely that things will go wrong. And it does have quite a few action scenes, including a fairly complicated sword fight between Macbeth and Macduff, making it more risky to perform. You may have realised by now that I'm a tad sceptical about the curse thing, but in the interest of fair play, I have to admit that Macbeth has certainly had more than its share of mishaps. Theatre manager Lillian Bayliss died from a heart attack on the night of the dress rehearsal for the Old Vic's 1937 production, which starred Laurence Olivier. During that same rehearsal, a falling stage weight just missed landing on Larry, where he wasn't Sir Larry until several years later. Then the director and the actress playing Lady Macbeth were involved in a car crash, which postponed the play's opening. On the first night, wait for it, Lillian Bayliss's portrait fell off the theatre wall. Maybe the string broke, or the picture hook was loose. It's possible, isn't it? The same production used real weapons, and one of them flew off the stage into the audience, giving someone a heart attack. There's also a story, more like a myth really, that at the play's first performance by Shakespeare's own company, the actor due to play Lady Macbeth died just before the first night. This explanation for the curse of Macbeth was later found to have been made up by Max Beerbohm, a cartoonist and critic who was fed up with the play's popularity. He owned up to this, but for some inexplicable reason, everybody believed it, and that's where the myth of bad luck began, and because of the play's supernatural content, the legend stuck. Let's face it, all sorts of things happen in plays, but it's not always down to Macbeth. If someone falls off the stage in another play, and it's probably happened at some time or other, no one's particularly interested. Well, apart from the poor actor involved. Most actors still refer to Macbeth as the Scottish play, rather than use its title, and just to be on the safe side, have adopted some rather complicated countermeasures which must be implemented if someone inadvertently says Macbeth. It appears that the best method to counteract the curse is to simply go outside and run around the theatre, or spin on the spot 3 times. Spit, that's not very hygienic, is it? Then swear, Even better. Or quote a line from another Shakespeare play, if you can remember one. Finally, wait to be invited back into the theatre. Phew! I ask you, could you be bothered?
TNF Soundings.
I hope you enjoyed the New York vocalised description of the New York Stock Exchange. This time, Marty Markowitz describes the parachute jump at Coney Island Amusement Park.
Hello, I'm Marty Markowitz, president of the Borough of Brooklyn. I want to describe for you the parachute jump tower at Coney Island. This structure, which we now call proudly Brooklyn's Eiffel Tower, is an official New York City landmark, and I'm proud to have been able to support the effort to restore it and bring it to bright new life as a shining symbol of the revitalization of Coney Island. Beginning in 1941, the parachute jump was a thrill ride, the main attraction at Steeplechase Park, one of the amusement parks at America's favorite playground, Coney Island, USA. People would sit in a leather sling, be raised 250 feet in the air, and then a parachute would open above them, and they'd float gently down to earth. Strangely enough, the jump was originally designed for a military purpose, to train the paratroopers who would be fighting in World War II. But it took on another purpose once the amusement industry found out how fun it was for thrill seekers to climb so high and glide back down with such grace. Sadly, in 1968, it was decided that the jump was too costly to maintain as a working ride. The beautiful cloth canopies and cables were removed, and the tall, flower-shaped steel tower began to rust and fall into disrepair. So here it was, 257 feet tall, about as tall as a 25-story building. This sleek tower with beams and girders in crisscross patterns, creating an elegant lacework against the background of the sunset sky. There are three parts to the jump's steel skeleton. Its tall vertical tower is topped by a horizontal circle of steel that fans outward. All around the outside of the circle are smaller round wheels. If the tower were the stem of a flower, those steel circles would be its petals. The sides of the tower are not straight up and down. They gently curve in toward each other as they go from the ground to the top of the tower. To feel what I mean, hold your palms in front of your chest, facing each other about a foot apart. Now move your hands up from your chest upward, gradually bringing your palms closer together as they move up. When your arms are fully extended, that will be the approximate shape of the tower. As I said, on the very top of the tower is a horizontal circular structure. It's about 85 feet in diameter. Those 12 smaller wheels around its edges are what the parachutes used to be attached to. I remember my friends riding them down while I stood safely on the ground, waved to them, probably while eating a Nathan's hot dog or two, and I'm sure large French fries. Thankfully, when the city wanted to pull down the tower in the 1970s, some very smart community activists made the case that it had value as a priceless piece of New York City pop culture history. They worked to have the jump declared a landmark. We were able to give the tower the respect it deserves, and a brand new image with the help of modern lighting design. Now the entire tower is painted a deep red, and in the summer of 2006, the artist Lenny Schwingdinger designed special lights for the tower. Every evening, 17 floodlights and 450 LEDs create patterns of moving lights on the tower. There are six lighting schemes that reflect the seasons, holidays, and even the lunar cycles. So after almost 40 years in the dark, the parachute jump once again lights up the Coney Island skyline. I like to think of it as a beacon of light for this and future generations, and a symbol of growth and development for Coney Island and for all of Brooklyn.
Now, as I mentioned at the beginning, here from TNF Soundings is a list of audio-described programs available on television. I hope you find it useful.
TNF Soundings. Features from across the UK.
Here is my selection of audio-described television programmes I hope you find of interest in the week Saturday the 4th to Friday the 10th of September 2021. So, let's start Saturday the 4th with Ainsley's Good Mood Food on ITV at 11:40 a.m. The chef celebrates mood-boosting food, starting with seaside-inspired dishes. On Channel 4 at 4:20 p.m, Guy Martin's War Machines. Guy looks back over four engineering projects involving war machines. There's a challenge for Hercule Poirot in Agatha Christie's Hickory Dickory Dock on ITV3 at 4:55 p.m. There are brutal murders at a student hostel on Hickory Road. On ITV this evening, starting at 5:30, there's Catchphrase for Soccer Aid. Footballer David James, broadcaster Martin Humes, and musician Chelsea Grimes say what they see to win £50,000 for UNICEF. On Channel 4 at 8, Betty Hughes' Treasures of the World continues with the historian looking at the treasures of Malta. Casualty continues at 9:30 on BBC One. Tensions escalate between Jacob and Tina as outsider Ian gets a disturbing insight into their issues. The late film on ITV at 11:05 is The Bourne Legacy, an action thriller. A CIA operation is compromised, so the chiefs decide to kill all the agents involved, but Aaron escapes the onslaught. Can he contact the one person who can help maintain his enhanced functions in time? And now on to Sunday, the 5th of September. There's another Bond film on ITV at 1:10. You Only Live Twice. Sean Connery as 007 is dispatched to Japan to face arch-enemy Blofeld. Or do you fancy a five-star war drama in which we serve? The Radio Times Film of the Week is on BBC Two at 1:30 p.m. and stars Noel Coward, John Mills and Celia Johnson. HMS Torin is struck by German bombers and sinks. Captain Kinross, played by Coward, rallies his crew as they cling to the wreckage. Episode 3 of Serengeti 2 is on BBC One at 5:35 p.m. Renewal, following the flood, some leopard cubs decide they can do better than mum by hunting a mongoose, but it proves elusive. Part 4 of Bleak House is on the Drama Channel at 6:50. This evening, Lady Dedlock's secret is revealed. At 8 on BBC Two, Mortimer and Whitehouse gone fishing. Bob and Paul accept a special invitation to fish at Burley House on the Cambridgeshire-Lincolnshire border. Can they land some bream or even the large pike that's said to inhabit one of the lakes? On ITV at 8, there's Vera. In Recovery, DCI Stanhope delves into the life of a profoundly private woman to solve the murder of an addiction support worker. Part 3 of the crime drama Vigil is on BBC One at 9. Amy starts to question whom she can trust of the submarine crew, only to find she's being deliberately undermined. There's the final part of When Ruby Wax Met at 9 on BBC Two. Ruby reflects on interviews with Imelda Marcos, Roseanne Barr, and a frightening encounter with Bill Cosby. Radio Times implies this isn't audio described, but the rest of the series has been, so I assume there's a typing error. Also at 9, but on Channel 4, there's the second part of Celebrity SAS Who Dares Wins. Several recruits question their place on the course as the tasks continue. On the Drama Channel at 9:25 p.m. is Hattie, the true life drama about Hattie Jake's affair with a younger man, while still married to John Le Mesurier. On BBC Four at 10 p.m, Pompeii, the mystery of the people frozen in time. Margaret Mountford visits the Roman town to try and explain how the people of the town, revealed by their body casts, became frozen in time, to dispel some of the myths surrounding the events of AD 79. On Monday, the 6th of September, Holmes Under the Hammer is on every day this week at 11:15 a.m. on BBC One. Today, looking at developments in Yorkshire, Greater Manchester and Newcastle under Lyme. Doctors returns to BBC One at 1:45 p.m. today, also on every day this week. Escape to the Country is also on BBC One at 3 p.m. every day. Today, Nikki Chapman helps couples move to Shropshire. On BBC Two at 4:15 p.m. and every day this week, Who Do You Think You Are? Today, Danny Dyer researches his East End family. All the soaps are audio described, and as a reminder, they are Neighbours on Channel 5 at 5:30 p.m, followed by Home and Away, also on Channel 5 at 6, Hollyoaks on Channel 4 at 6:30 p.m, Emmerdale at 7 on ITV, Coronation Street at 7:30 and 8:30 on ITV, and EastEnders on BBC One at 8:10 p.m. There's a Ruth Rendell mystery on ITV3 at 5:55 p.m. A Case of Coincidence is in two parts shown back to back. A girl's body is found in the fens. The investigation takes a complicated turn as more fatalities are reported. At 8 p.m. on ITV, James Martin, Islands and Highlands. James concludes his journey on the Isle of Skye, where he's joined by fellow chef Tony Singh. Part 5 of Ghosts is on BBC One at 8:30. The ghosts try to sabotage Alison's therapy session for Kitty, but they unwittingly have to face their own demons. Part 2 of Stephen is on ITV at 9 p.m. DCI Clive Driscoll tries to win the trust of the Lawrence family. Over on BBC One at 9 p.m. there's a new series of Silent Witness. The crime drama returns with a two-part story, Redemption, on Tonight and Tomorrow. Jack and Nikki enter a prison to investigate a suspicious death. Also at 9, but on Channel 4, a series of three programmes, Bin Laden, The Road to 9/11, profiling Osama bin Laden's transformation from quiet boy to global terrorist. And now on to Tuesday, the 7th of September. At 7:30 p.m. on ITV, Wonders of Scotland with David Heyman. The Scottish actor explores the scenery, history and culture of his homeland. Holby City is on BBC One at 7:50. Lucky discovers the dark truth about Jenny's actions. Alan Titchmarsh shows how to love your garden on ITV at 8. The team head for Bedfordshire to surprise a paramedic with an Asian-inspired garden makeover. The Secret Life of the Zoo on Channel 4, also at 8. There's trouble in the zoo's chimp family as females battle for dominance. Still at 8 p.m. but on BBC Two, you could be Saving Lives at Sea. New volunteer Emma faces her first rescue as a rock climber has fallen into the water and is in danger of becoming unconscious. At 9 p.m. on ITV, 9/11 Life Under Attack, featuring rare audio and never-seen-before footage, giving a unique perspective on the events on the 11th of September 2001. Filmed by ordinary citizens and shown without interview or commentary, but hopefully some good audio description. BBC Two at 9 has a new series of A House Through Time. David Olusoga discovers the history of 5 Grosvenor Mount, a Victorian home in the Headingley suburb of Leeds. If you've been watching Deceit about the Met's investigation of the Rachel Nickell murder, there's a follow-up on Channel 4 at 10 p.m. Death on the Common, My Mother's Murder. Alex, Rachel's 2-year-old son, was the only witness to the murder. After 30 years, he returns to the scene of the crime and explores the events that followed. On Wednesday the 8th of September, starting in the evening at 7:30 p.m. on BBC One, For Pete's Sake, Our Lives, Young and Old Cherish the Tradition of Peat Cutting on the Isle of Lewis. Margaret Rowan was introduced to the craft when she moved to Lewis to fulfil her dream of becoming a Harris tweed weaver, with lots of choice at 8. The repair shop on BBC One, the team repair a wind-up racing car, an oak box which is affected by damp, a 100-year-old plate camera, and a 1940s clockwork marionette theatre. On BBC Two at 8, a new series of Animals with Cameras. Gordon Buchanan is off the west coast of Africa, watching loggerhead turtles as they film their nesting season, and in the Bahamas with reef sharks as they glide through gullies of coral inaccessible to human divers. Earth's Greatest Rivers is on BBC Four at 8. This final part looks at the Mississippi, from frozen waterfalls and time-travelling barges to beavers in swamps. Changing Rooms continues on Channel 4 at 8. Tonight they're in Barnstable, adding storage to Sarah's cluttered bedroom. Channel 4 at 9, Grand Designs. Olaf and Fritha have a tiny triangular plot between a railway and an A-road. Can they build a house to suit the plot and their budget? For A Gentler Way of Life, Sheila Hancock and Giles Brandreth continue their Great Canal journeys at 9 on More 4, travelling along the Grand Union and Stratford Canal to Stratford-upon-Avon, where Sheila performed at the Royal Shakespeare Theatre. Thursday the 9th starts with another Ruth Rendell mystery, May and June, on ITV3 at 5:40. Again, two episodes back-to-back, when two estranged sisters are reconciled. One is consumed with jealousy over the other's lavish lifestyle. Then May begins to take over her sister's identity with fatal consequences. Joe Lycett's Got Your Back, the consumer programme on Channel 4 at 8 p.m. This week, Joe bags a massive financial victory with the Co-op and looks into deliveries in the Highlands. Also at 8, but on BBC One, Celebrity MasterChef. The remaining 7 celebrities must recreate one of restaurateur Neves Barragan's signature recipes. At 9 on Channel 4, 16, Class of 2021. Pressure mounts as the final term approaches and the students of Link Academy in Dudley need to make decisions about their futures and careers. Also at 9 on BBC Two, A Killing in Tiger Bay looks at the murder of Lynette White. Despite witnesses saying they saw a white man at the crime scene, the 10-month investigation concludes with arrest of 5 young black men. This series lays bare the twists and turns of one of Britain's most notorious miscarriages of justice. And finally to Friday, the 10th of September. Father Brown is on the Drama Channel at 8. The missing man, the priest believes the suicide of recently returned pilot is murder. Grantchester continues on ITV at 9. Will and Geordie are drawn into a family dispute following the disruption of a baptism by a man claiming to be the baby's rightful father. Are there connections to the murder of Joan Beaumont, head of the local adoption agency? Celebrity MasterChef continues at 9 on BBC One. The celebrities must cook one dish for 3 of the country's most feared restaurant critics. The drama of the week is on BBC Two at 9:30 p.m. The North Water. In 1859, Patrick Sumner boards a whaling ship in Hull to escape his troubled past. Also on board is harpooner and murderer Henry Drax. This is a series of 5 programmes. The comedy of the week is on BBC One, also at 9:30. The Cleaner is a black comedy starring Greg Davis. Professional crime scene cleaner Winky is in a hurry to mop up after a grisly murder, but keeps being interrupted by a heavily armed woman. You could end the day with Shakespeare in Love, the 5-star rated comedy film starring Gwyneth Paltrow. Will Shakespeare is running out of money and has writer's block. But when he meets Viola de Lesseps, his life and the world of English literature is designed to change forever. I hope you find something of interest in my selection this week.
DNF Soundings.
Now, to mark the 355th anniversary of the Great Fire of London in 1666, this from TNF Soundings.
TNF Soundings. Features from across the UK.
Hello, this is Nikki with an article by Jane on the Great Fire of London. September this year marks the 355th anniversary of the Great Fire of London in 1666, which was a dreadful catastrophe for the City of London and everyone who lived there. A huge fire swept through a bakery in Pudding Lane in the city in the early hours and spread into the surrounding streets. Reports estimate that the temperature in the bakery rose to 1,250 degrees centigrade. The fire destroyed many well-known buildings of the time, including St Paul's Cathedral, and at least 70,000 medieval homes situated within the Roman walls of the city. Buildings at that time were made largely of wood, so the fire damage was immense and the flames rose high into the air. It is reported that 87 parish churches were also burnt to the ground. It wasn't until 4 days later that the fire was brought under control and clearing up of all the remains began. It took weeks, months, and sometimes years for buildings to be either renovated or rebuilt so that people could return home. The St Paul's Cathedral that we know today was rebuilt in the same area as the old cathedral destroyed by the fire. Looking at the area now, it is difficult to believe the fire ever took place if you didn't originally know of the history of those dreadful days. Fortunately, most inhabitants of the city were able to flee to safety, as reports estimate that apparently only around 9 people were killed in the Great Fire, but many others had severe injuries. The diarist, Samuel Pepys, lived through the fire, and he stated that it made him cry to see such damage to so many people.
DNF Soundings.
Finally, let's have a look at events and birthdates in the past that happened in this upcoming week. On the 5th of September in 1972, 11 Israeli athletes are taken hostage and later killed by the Palestinian Black September group at the Munich Olympics. On the same date in 1975, 2 people are killed and 63 injured as a suspected IRA bomb explodes in the lobby of the Hilton Hotel in central London. In 1977, space probe Voyager 1 is launched by NASA as part of the Voyager program to study the outer solar system. The outer solar system includes everything that is beyond planet Mars. On the 6th of September in 1651, Charles II spends the day hiding in an oak tree following defeat by Oliver Cromwell at Worcester. The Great Fire of London is finally extinguished after much of the city and St Paul's Cathedral are lost. In 1997, on the 6th of September, Britain and the world say farewell to Diana, Princess of Wales, at the end of an unprecedented week of mourning. On the 7th of September in 1940, Germany begins systematic heavy air raids on British cities known as the Blitz, as 900 bombers hit London. In 1976, on that date, ABBA were at number 1 on the UK singles chart with Dancing Queen. The song topped the charts in more than 12 countries and stayed at the top of the Swedish charts for 14 weeks. On the 8th of September in 1944, the first German V2 rocket lands on London. It hits Chiswick, killing 3 people. In 1950, rescuers say 160 miners trapped in a colliery in Scotland following a landslide, thankfully, are safe. And on the 8th of September in 1968, the Beatles were seen performing Hey Jude on the UK television show Frost on Sunday in front of an invited audience. On the 9th of September in 1977, David Bowie appeared on Mark Bolan's ITV show, singing a duet together. After the show, the pair recorded demos together, but they were never finished because sadly Mark Bolan was killed in a car crash a week later. On the 9th of September in 1987, 25 Liverpool football fans involved in the Heysel Stadium disaster are extradited to Belgium to stand trial. And in 1988, on that date, the Indian cricket tour was cancelled because English cricket captain Graham Gooch and seven other members of his squad were refused visas to travel to India. On the 10th of September in 1963, American Express, one of the world's largest banking houses, opens a credit card service in Britain. In 1973, fashionable Bieber opens a huge department store in London's Kensington High Street, offering everything from trendy clothes to designer furniture and a food hall. And on the 10th of September in 1988, the television presenters Mike Smith and Sarah Green are seriously injured in a helicopter crash in Gloucestershire. On the 11th of September in 1944, the invasion of Germany from the west begins as Allied troops cross the Luxembourg-German border. In 1997, on that date, voters in Scotland approve the creation of a Scottish Parliament in a national referendum. And on the 11th of September in 2001, attacks by Islamic terrorists on New York's World Trade Center and Washington killed 2,973 people. And here are some birth dates from the past that happened this week. On the 5th of September, Freddie Mercury, born Farouk Bulsara, was born in 1946. He was a British singer, songwriter, record producer and lead vocalist of the rock band Queen. Regarded as one of the greatest lead singers in the history of rock music, he was known for his flamboyant stage persona and four-octave vocal range. Born in Zanzibar to Parsi parents from England, he attended English-style boarding schools in India from the age of eight and returned to Zanzibar after secondary school. In 1964, his family fled the Zanzibar Revolution, moving to Middlesex, England. Having studied and written music for years, he formed Queen in 1970 with guitarist Brian May and drummer Roger Taylor. Mercury wrote numerous hits for Queen, including Killer Queen, Bohemian Rhapsody, Someone to Love, We Are the Champions, Don't Stop Me Now, and Crazy Little Thing Called Love. His charismatic stage performances often saw him interact with the audience, such as the 1985 Live Aid concert. Mercury died in 1991 at the age of 45 due to complications from AIDS. On the 6th of September in 1972, Idris Elba was born. He's an English actor, writer, producer, musician, DJ, rapper and singer. He is known for roles including Stringer Bell in the HBO series The Wire, DCI Luther in the BBC One series Luther, and Nelson Mandela in the biographical film Mandela: Long Walk to Freedom in 2013. He has been nominated four times for a Golden Globe Award for Best Actor, miniseries or television film, winning one, and was nominated five times for a Primetime Emmy Award. As of May 2019, his films have grossed over $9.8 billion at the global box office, including over $3.6 billion in North America, where he is one of the top 20 highest-grossing actors. On the 7th of September, in 1533, Elizabeth I was born. She was Queen of England and Ireland from 17th of November 1958 until her death on the 24th of March 1603. Sometimes called the Virgin Queen, Gloriana or Good Queen Bess, Elizabeth was the last of five monarchs of the House of Tudor. She was the daughter of Henry VIII and Anne Boleyn, his second wife, who was executed 2.5 years after Elizabeth's birth. One of her first actions as queen was the establishment of an English Protestant church, of which she became the supreme governor. This Elizabethan religious settlement was to evolve into the Church of England. After the Pope declared her illegitimate in 1570 and released her subjects from obedience to her, several conspiracies threatened her life, all of which were defeated with the help of her minister's secret service. Elizabeth is acknowledged as a charismatic performer and a dogged survivor in an era when government was ramshackle and limited, and when monarchs in neighbouring countries faced internal problems that jeopardised their thrones. After the short reigns of her half-siblings, her 44 years on the throne provided welcome stability for the kingdom and helped forge a sense of national identity. On the 8th of September in 1925, Peter Sellers CBE was born. He was an English film actor, comedian and singer. He performed in the BBC radio series The Goon Show, featured on a number of hit comic songs, and became known to a worldwide audience through his many film roles, among them Chief Inspector Clouseau in the Pink Panther series of films. He developed his mimicry and improvisational skills in Ralph Reeder's wartime gang show Entertainment Troupe, which toured Britain and the Far East. After the war, Sellers made his radio debut in Showtime, and eventually became a regular performer on various BBC radio shows. During the early 1950s, Sellers, along with Spike Milligan, Harry Secombe and Michael Benteen, took part in the successful radio series The Goon Show, which ended in 1960. Sellers then began his film career during the 1950s. Although the bulk of his work was comedic, often parodying characters of authority such as military officers or policemen, he also performed in other film genres and roles. Films demonstrating his artistic range include I'm All Right Jack in 1959, Stanley Kubrick's Lolita in 1962, and Dr. Strangelove in 1964. He won the BAFTA Award for Best Actor in a Leading Role twice, for I'm All Right Jack, and for the original Pink Panther film, The Pink Panther, and was nominated as Best Actor three times. In 1980, he won the Golden Globe Award for Best Actor, Motion Picture, Musical or Comedy, for his role in Being There, and was previously nominated three times in the same category. His behaviour was often erratic and compulsive, and he frequently clashed with his directors and co-stars, especially in the mid-1970s when his physical and mental health, together with his alcohol and drug problems, were at their worst. Sellers was married four times and had three children from his first two marriages. He died from a heart attack, aged 54, in 1980. English filmmakers the Bolting Brothers described Sellers as the greatest comic genius this country has produced since Charlie Chaplin. On the 9th of September, the unknown child was born in 1910. It refers to the initially unidentified body of Sidney Goodwin, which was recovered by the Mackay-Bennett after sinking of the RMS Titanic. For almost a century, Goodwin's gravestone in the Fairview Cemetery read, "Erected to the memory of an unknown child whose remains were recovered after the disaster to the Titanic, April the 15th, 1912. Initial DNA testing in 2002 pointed to third-class passenger Aino Viemi Panula as the probable individual. However, subsequent testing in 2008 conclusively identified the child's remains as those of fellow third-class toddler Sidney Goodwin. On the 10th of September 1968, Guy Stewart Ritchie was born. He's an English film director, film producer, screenwriter and businessman, known for his British gangster films. In 1995, he directed his first film, The Hard Case, a 20-minute short that impressed investors who backed his first feature film, the crime comedy Lock, Stock and Two Smoking Barrels, in 1998. He then directed another Cockney crime comedy, Snatch, in 2000. His British-set gangster films have featured emerging stars such as Jason Statham, Idris Elba and Tom Hardy. He directed Sherlock Holmes in 2009, its sequel, Sherlock Holmes: A Game of Shadows, in 2011, and the live-action adaptation of Disney's Aladdin in 2019. On the 11th of September in 1885, David Herbert Lawrence was born. He was an English writer and poet. His collected works represent, among other things, an extended reflection upon the dehumanizing effects of modernity and industrialization. Some of the issues Lawrence explores are sexuality, emotional health, vitality, spontaneity, and instinct. Lawrence's opinions earned him many enemies, and he endured official persecution, censorship, and misrepresentation of his creative work throughout the second half of his life, much of which he spent in a voluntary exile he called his Savage Pilgrimage. At the time of his death, his public reputation was that of a pornographer who had wasted his considerable talents. E.M. Forster, in an obituary notice, challenged this widely held view, describing him as the greatest imaginative novelist of our generation. Later, the literary critic F.R. Leavis championed both his artistic integrity and his moral seriousness. And that finishes up this edition of Primary. My thanks to Jane, Christine, Andy, David, Deborah, and Jess for reading the news, to Angela for providing the radio listings, and John who read them. Thanks also to Michael and Marty, all at TNF Soundings, Wendy, Hazel and Joan for the week in history and famous birthdays, and, as always, to Rob Pearman for all his support. Primary will be back in 4 weeks' time. Let me take this opportunity to wish you a safe and enjoyable September. Please remember to return your USB stick and wallet after use, and please stay well and safe at home. Goodbye.